Hello and welcome to the Reverend Hunter Podcast. This is Tony Jones, the Reverend Hunter, joined as always by the hooch to my Turner, Brandon.
You know what? Dogs are man's best friend. It's a funny movie with Tom Hanks. I'm good with that one as well. That works. How you doing?
All right. Good. I'm good. I'll just like to take on that everyman role like Tom Hanks. And you know,
there you go.
Can play any role, do anything. Brandon, man, how you been? You staying cool in the basement?
I am staying cool in the basement. I've been very well. Yeah. Just getting back to the grind of Monday morning, as they say, you know.
Your voice sounds particularly low and radio DJ today.
You know, I bet it's because I'm using a different headset mic and I'm using a different board and everything. I'm using a completely new setup today. So
no kidding. You upgraded, huh?
Kind of. I loaned some equipment out to other shows for other things and stuff. So I'm just dealing with what I got.
Oh, so maybe not upgrading.
It's old stuff, but it works.
Good. Well, you sound good. You sound good. The dog days are here. Late July, early August in Minnesota, and we're in the middle of this drought, and we got a stretch of 90 degree days as far as the eye can see. What do you make of that?
It's much of the same so far this summer. It just feels like it's just going to be awfully dry. It's fun. It's nice for me in the sense that I haven't really had to mow my lawn in a month and a half. But right. Other than that, it's horrible for everything else.
Really tired of it. I was up north, and the creek that runs through our property and feeds our lake is, you know, just mud. There's really no water flowing through it to speak of. The lake is down a foot. I don't like it. I don't like these extremes. I would rather have normal summers. And now I'm a month away from Boundary Waters trip in August. And right now, not only is there a total fire ban in the Boundary Waters, and for good reason, but many of the entry points have been closed because of wildfires up there. So just makes it really tricky. And I just don't know that within the next month, even if it rains a lot, I don't know that it's going to rain enough to, you know, mitigate the drought. This is the problem.
Yeah. How does that make for camping up there when you can't have fires or anything like that? You just got to cook with a butane stove and everything.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I use a white gas stove. But even then it's a little nerve wracking. You know, that's exactly how you cook. But you know, there's something about the ambiance of the fire and by late August, you know, most likely it'll be cool at night, so it'd be nice to have a fire. I don't know, fingers crossed. I'd love to have a super wet August and get us back into it. I've heard good reports from like South Dakota that the dry weather actually is really good for like the pheasant hatch and stuff like that. But the problem comes when because there's such a lack of pasture, you know, grass for cows, that they start to open up wildlife preserves or CRP land or other basically land that is reserved for habitat for pheasants, and they open it up to cattle grazing because there's such a dearth of grass for the cattle. And that's a huge bummer if that happens. So anyway,
it's just yet another bad year. We thought 2020 was going to be the worst of it, but 2021 is showing us that, nah, we got something else planned.
Yeah. 2021 is not the greatest, but I mean, if people check out the Reverend Hunter on Instagram, you'll see I've been doing some dog training and, you know, had some people up at the lake and doing some cooking and stuff like that. So that's pretty cool. Tonight I'm having, my core posse of pheasant hunting buddies over for dinner. We're going to have some pheasant in the new kitchen, and we're going to plan out all of our hunting trips for this fall. So that's always a super exciting time and starting to look toward, you know, the hunting season.
That's really cool. How is that new kitchen, by the way? Are you having fun cooking in it?
Yeah, come on over. I'll cook you up some pheasant.
It looks like the perfect like social type of kitchen too, where you can cook and
eat all at once. I mean, I could actually, I was thinking like I could actually film like a cooking TV show in here. It's got kind of that vibe too. So who knows?
Hey, there you go.
Well, the sky's the limit.
We'll get some tripods set up and I'll run the audio.
Well, speaking of hunting and looking forward to the fall, my guest today is such a dear friend. We met in about 1999. Jason Mitchell and I worked together in the church world. And then it was only later that we kind of discovered a shared love of hunting. He's particularly a duck a waterfowl hunter, but particularly a duck hunter. And as you'll hear in the interview, I mean, one of the things that's so intriguing about my buddy Mitch is that his father owns one of the last and most storied handmade duck call companies in the world. And, you know, Jason's made just, you know, myriad duck calls himself. In fact, gave me one. And you'll get to hear a little tutorial by him on how to blow a duck call. But also, friends, stay tuned till the very end of the episode. Having heard Jason blow his duck call, you can listen to me blow my Iverson duck call at the end of the episode. And, you know, let us know, send me some social media and tell me how you think my duck call stands up to Mitch's. As always, friends, we would love it if you would subscribe, rate, review, and share the Reverend Hunter podcast with everyone you know who you think might be interested in deeper conversations about finding meaning in the outdoors. We love your support. We appreciate it. And now here's my conversation with my friend, my duck hunting buddy, and the heir apparent to the Iverson duck call empire, Jason Mitchell. Jason Mitchell, man, thanks for coming on this show. Do you know why do you think I had you on here?
I don't know.
Because there's a very famous hunting. There's a very famous hunting celebrity named Jason Mitchell.
Oh, I see. So you're trying to get clickbait with my name.
Jason Mitchell Outdoors, isn't that guy's?
Yes.
Isn't there some famous hunting guy like that? It's funny because When you and I were trying to scheme up a big duck hunting odyssey, you know, 1,500-mile trip, I posted something about it on Instagram or something, and somebody DM'd me like, "You're going hunting? You're like, you're going on a 3-week duck hunting trip with Jason Mitchell?" It's
like, well, the other thing that happens to me on social media for whatever reason, it's become a popular name. So the actor that played Eazy-E in Straight Outta Compton was a guy named Jason Mitchell. And so before that movie came out, he hit me up on Instagram or on Twitter and wanted to buy my handle because I actually have at Jason Mitchell. And anyways, but he kept offering like additional amounts of money, which started at 20 and might have got to 35. And I was like, sorry, dude, come on.
Wait, like $35?
Yes. It wasn't even legitimate. And even in Instagram, like last month, I received a DM from some kid in high school who wants to go very far playing football and would like my Jason Mitchell handle. So,
oh my gosh,
so funny!
Hang on to those; they might be worth a lot of money.
that's the closest I am to famous, except for knowing you, of course. But
hey, man, we have been on a couple hunts together. And neither of them was very successful.
Yeah.
The first one, you and I went, we hunted ducks in some flooded timber in East Texas.
Yes, that was Lake Fork.
Okay, and I don't think you even brought a gun.
Well, because I only think one of us had a license, i.e. me. Because you were down here, you were down at some youth speaking event in downtown Dallas. And I can remember pulling in with my Bronco and duck boat into that little, and the guys from the hotel at 3:30 in the morning going, "What in the hell is going on?" And then you rolled down and jumped in and we left.
And I remember you calling extraordinarily well. I shot not well at all. I don't know that did I even hit a single duck?
Yeah, we ended up getting a few birds, including we were so proud because we shot a few canvasbacks that day, and I found out like 48 hours later that canvasback season didn't start for another week. So oh my God. I hope the game warden, what's the, you know, statute of limitations on that?
I mean, this was a long time ago. And then, but by the aspect I remember most is we stopped in some little town in East Texas.
Emory, Texas.
Emory, okay. And I was wearing Crocs. Camo. Yes, I was wearing my duck camo, and I'd taken off the whatever boots you loaned me, and I was wearing Crocs, and you just kind of rolled your eyes like, this is not going to go well. And we walked into this diner, and it was like all cowboys, and you and me in camo, and me in Crocs. And I don't I think I had the only pair of Crocs in that zip code.
It was the one time where I felt I could identify with the guys from Easy Rider. You remember that movie?
yeah. And then the other time you flew all the way to Minnesota for a duck opener. And I have quit hunting ducks on our lake because I've had too many duck openers, just like the one when you visited. We did not shoot a single duck.
Yeah.
However, I will never forget the stealth operation we pulled on that Canada goose.
Yeah, I think we were motivated because, we were, I think, hungry after not shooting in the morning, and we saw a goose that didn't seem to want to get off the water. I made
you, first of all, after not shooting anything in the morning, I made you hike through like waist deep.
Well, I don't know that you made me. I think I was sort of like, hey, what if I go around this direction? And then
That was later. At first, we walked through a slough, and you were kind of like, what the hell, bro? And I thought, oh, we're going to sneak up on this creek. And a lot of times there are teal or woodies in this creek, and we're going to sneak up on them. And so we went, instead of going up over the ridge, we came down low through this slough. It was like we were knee to waist deep in muck. And it was, it's opening weekend, so it's hot and sweaty and buggy. It's not yet cold. It's not what people think about when they think about duck hunting. And by the time we got there and there were no woodies or teal, it was pretty brutal. So then we went to another spot, which I now affectionately call Mitchell Pond. And I just have such vivid memories of this. We crested over a ridge and looked down into this pond, and I said, well, what the heck? Why is there a goose decoy?
One solitary goose.
There's just a goose decoy just floating out in that, on the far side of that pond. That makes no sense. We don't even own goose decoys at that point. I don't think I did own any. And I was like, maybe somebody was poaching on our land and left that goose decoy out there. And then you said, I think it just moved. Sure enough, it was just a solo goose. So I went straight down, and I remember army crawling on a floating bog with just like water coming in.
Yes.
Like water pouring down the neck of my jacket. You know, we were going to stop at nothing to get this goose. You went around the far way, and you must have done a similar deal.
Yes. I kept expecting that thing. I assumed I wasn't going to have to do the whole walk. That's why I volunteered, because I assumed he'd just get up, but he didn't get up. So I kept walking, and he did eventually, which was funny.
And you dropped it.
Well, I think I winged it, and then you dropped it.
Well, we both shot, and Albert made a fantastic retrieve.
That ended up being super long, because I think he had to go through water, then like over an island, and then through and get back in the water or something like that. I remember it being super impressive.
And that goose was not dead.
No.
When he brought that goose back to me, it was not dead. So he had a goose hissing at him on the entire retrieve back to me.
Yes.
Which was so epic. He was such an epic dog, and I'm so glad that you got to hunt with him.
Yeah, he was. That was a great retrieve.
Now my goal is that you get to hunt with Crosby sometime, who is a fantastic hunting dog in his own right.
We will make that happen.
I just got some great news today. I I got a lot. The South Dakota waterfowl licenses for non-residents go by lottery, and I won one.
Yeah, I saw you post that. So literally, to hunt ducks in South Dakota, if you're not a resident, you have to basically go through a lottery process. I didn't know
that.
Yeah,
and what I've been told by people is that because so many non-residents come and shoot pheasants,
sure,
that it's the way that the South Dakota Fish and Game and the South Dakota State Legislature kind of threw a bone to resident hunters, like, hey, yeah, we're constantly recruiting non-residents to come shoot our pheasants, but you guys get the ducks.
That's sort of how they negotiated peace.
Yeah. So in that way they can just limit the number of duck hunters. But the license I applied for is not that hard to get because it's a 3-day license and I can only hunt on private land in one little part of the state. So if you narrow it down and know what you're doing, you've got a pretty good chance of winning. And on the other hand, an earlier guest of mine had said, oh man, come antelope hunt with me in Wyoming. Like everybody gets a doe license in Wyoming for antelope. In fact, you can get 2 a year and I've never been turned down. So he told me where to like apply and this and that. So I did all that and I did not get a license and neither did he. So
the first time in history.
Yeah. And he's heard that, I don't know, they had a bad winter or the antelope numbers are down, or blame Steven Rinella because so many guys big game hunt now.
There's just a surge in that for sure. Do you hunt with that? You have a friend that you pheasant hunt up in the Dakotas. Is that the same connections you have for waterfowl, or what do you do for waterfowl?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he's got a quarter section and a part of it is flooded.
Oh, nice.
So he keeps texting me photos of, you know, ducks sitting on it, but the amount of, I mean, they're in just, we're all in a drought. You're currently in California and
huge drought here too.
Dodging wildfires, I'm sure. And, yep. It's really drought conditions in the Dakotas. It's real bad. So it's actually quite good for the pheasants.
Right.
Because they had a really dry, easy winter and spring in the Dakotas, which is great for pheasants. The one bad thing is if the drought persists, you know, for pheasant chicks, they get most of their protein from bugs. And if the drought, you know, devastates the bug population. In fact, a friend of mine who lives out there, who's a biologist, she swears that the reason that the pheasant numbers are down and all wildlife numbers are down is because, you know, that all the Roundup Ready seeds that are planted. So because the crops, there's no weeds in the crops, there's no place for bugs. Because there's no bugs, there's no protein source. Right,
and that's huge for waterfowl too, because the waterfowl towards the end of the year will thrive on invertebrates to up their protein levels to prepare to fly back north. And that's definitely an issue for them as well.
Yeah. So anyways, we've had a couple not great hunts, but we've had many, many good times together. When did we first meet? Would it have been like 2003, 2004, 2005 in there?
No, we would have. So I moved even to Dallas to work with Young Leader Networks in 1999. So you and I would have met in 99 at some
point. In 99?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
July of 99 we moved. Now, I don't know exactly when. And I don't think I met you immediately, but I know I met you along the way pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You're right.
I should have known that because your predecessor left in late 99 to start a church in Minnesota in 2000. Yeah.
Yep.
Gotcha. Okay. So yeah, that's when we, and before that, what were you doing? You had started a church in the Northwest or in.
Yeah. So Cheryl and I, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, moved to Southern California, go to seminary, met Cheryl. We got married. We moved to Vancouver, Washington, which is essentially a suburb of Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And we planted a church there in 1994, or we got there in 93, I guess, and then left in 99. So we were there 6 years.
What was the name of that church?
It's now known as River's Edge Church.
Okay. Oh, it's still going.
still going. The guy that I handed it off to, who is a good friend, and I got into duck hunting. He became a better duck hunter than I am. Amazing guy. Still pastoring it. And they moved because of a lot of, and I will say this, I think through a lot of the influence of what I was exposed to through friendships with guys like you and, you know, the Young Leader Network thing, he ended up taking that church out of the suburb and moving it downtown Vancouver and kind of taking on a different kind of mission. Mm-hmm. And so he was with me in Glorieta 1998 for that conference. So we were definitely influenced by all of that before it went to work. Yeah. So okay.
What was it called when you planted it? It had to have like an edgy emergent name.
No, I was a dork. I was not edgy emergent guy. Like I didn't know what I was doing. It was called River Heights Church.
Okay. Yeah.
So it was kind of a little generic suburbanish, but the church that we planted out of was, New Heights. And so we kind of named it a subset of that, I guess. But yeah, I know it was some really good times, you know, some of the best and hardest times of my life, and got into some really good duck hunting up in that part of the world too. It's amazing.
Sea, out on the sea or what? Where were you?
A little bit of everything, but the Columbia River's right there. So it's just, you have a ton of different directions. You can go hunt on the coast, on the Columbia, up towards Eastern Washington on the Columbia. Of course, there's, you know, non-river hunting as well, which we did. So a little bit of everything.
Awesome. Now let's hear about, you must have grown up hunting.
I did.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. So like I said, my dad, and mom grew up here in Marin County in a little town that's super exclusive and richy rich now. But at the time, you know, just regular folks live there called Belvedere, which is right on San Pablo Bay, which is the north end of San Francisco Bay. And so my dad grew up sailing and on the water hunting ducks, and he just took to hunting and then got into deer hunting pretty early on as a kid too. So growing up in our house, we went deer hunting, we went dove hunting, we went quail hunting, we went duck hunting, we did all of it. So definitely a part of my growing up, and probably the thing that I enjoyed the most was duck hunting. My dad started building a boat, a little skiff, a little 12-foot skiff, when I was the year I was born, and he finished it when I was like 12 or 13.
Are you serious?
Yes. Through a couple moves and, like, you know, it sat in the garage, and then a buddy of his, Dave Donzel, who is just a legendary hunter on the bay here, helped him finish it up one summer. And then from the rest of my junior high and high school was going out on the bay with my dad. And
in a little wooden boat.
Chasing ducks, little wooden boat. And he still got it here in the yard.
Come on, with a motor on the back?
Yep. I don't know if it holds water right now, but probably needs a little caulking.
Wow.
Fiberglass.
Tell me what it's like to hunt on that bay like that. I mean, is it rough water? Are you tucking the boat into reeds or what?
Exactly. So as a kid, and, you know, obviously did it as an adult too, but, you know, you motor out, and of course my dad and Dave were hunting buddies, and they were super old school about their approach. And they, you know, anything over a 4-horse motor is going too fast. So you plop the boat in at the Black Point Petaluma River entrance, and then you just bore out into the bay, and it can be blowing 40 miles an hour, and you're just chopping through the water. And it may
Is this a flat bottom boat?
It's kind of a modified V. So it's, you know, a V in front. So you're cutting through now, and these guys know what they're doing. They know how to design and build boats, my dad and Dave. And so they cut through the water, but, you know, you're 12 years old, you're getting soaked, just water's coming up over the bow for 45 minutes to an hour until you get to your spot, you know? And so, yes, then you determine which way you're going to go on the bay based on the wind direction. So if it's coming from the south, you're going to go to the south shore where you can get a lee, you know, or west or south, you can get a lee there. Or if it's coming, the wind's coming from the north or east, you're going to head up to the north shore, get a lee up there. And so you set your decoys up and back into the reeds and time it according to the tide, because it comes in and out as you go, you know, so you kind of plan your hunts around that as well.
And how many, what kind of ducks are you hunting for? And and what's your decoy setup?
Yeah, so there's you know, back in the day, you know, and probably less so now, there was large quantities of both puddle ducks and divers. So we would kind of have kind of two sets. So one side of the decoy set would be cans and bluebill, and we would set those up. And if we were set up down south, there tended to be more predominant divers on that side of the bay, so we'd probably use more diver setups there. But we would also set up on the other side of the rig puddle ducks, mostly pintail. And some mallards, and, you know, probably 30 to 40 birds we would put out on trot lines. So you have 3 to 6 decoys connected to one big weight. And so that was always fun putting them out picking them up in a 40 mile an hour wind.
Yeah. Because I'm guessing that you're not in waders in the water. You're doing all this from the boat, putting out the decoys and pulling them back in.
Yep. And it's a little stressful, and you know my dad's, you know, from the generation he's from, and so there was always a lot of barking and trying to put it all together and, you know, and making it happen. And then you finally get set up and you're like, the ducks start flying and you forget about all the wet and the cold and the decoy setup until you have to pick them up again at the end of the day.
I mean, that how big did you say this boat is?
It's tiny. I look at it now, and of course I'm put on a few pounds since I was 12 years old, but I don't know how we did it, you know, like, cause there were decoys. I can remember being kind of crunched up against the decoys in the front, and, you know, my knees were probably not too far from where he was kneeling in the front. And I would be facing backwards, you know, to kind of protect myself from the weather. And then he would be obviously, you know, be faced forward, but it's tiny. I mean, I can take a picture of it and send it to you.
And did you have a dog in that boat?
No, not then.
Okay. No.
We didn't hunt with dogs back then. I got my first dog when I was, I think, a sophomore in high school, and I trained him. And that was a whole nother dimension of duck hunting that was awesome. And by then, by the time I started, my brother got his license, and then I got my license, we started, you know, finding other ways to duck hunt. And also, honestly, where we grew up in a town called outside of a town called Novato, which is north of San Francisco by about 25 minutes. But we're outside of town in a little community called Black Point, which is literally I could walk from my parents' house to the marsh in the winter where, you know, water would stack up on the in the valley below where ducks would sit. And we could kind of in high school, basically walk down with our shotguns and shoot at birds down in that field. And then if we wanted to, we're really motivated, we could actually walk to the bay, take a little farther. But we did that. We poached private property and got chased around. God bless Mr. What was his name? Hoover, Mr. Hoover's ponds. They still exist. He donated the property to the fishing game. So those ponds still exist. You can't shoot there anymore. You'd be arrested. But back in the day, we just had all kinds of fun shooting those ponds.
Now, how would you retrieve those ducks with no dog?
Okay, so I had a paper route. Remember when paper routes existed?
Oh, I used to sub for a neighbor kid whenever he went out of town.
So I would break down my Model 97 12-gauge shotgun and place one half of the shotgun in my paper bag on the left and the other half in the paper bag on the right, stack the papers on top, deliver the papers. At the end of my route, I would shove my bike into these blackberry bushes where I would deliver my last paper. I would basically sneak onto this guy's property where a bunch of cans and bluebills would set up on this pond. I'd sneak out to this point. And because my dad told a crazy story about swimming out after his ducks, of course, as a kid, you wanted to do that too. So we figured out a way where you could sneak out to this point and the cans would kind of swim back behind you. Okay. And then when you fired a shot on the water, they would get up and then fly towards land and go, oh crap, the bay's the other direction, and then come back over you. So you had a you had a shot on the water, and then you would reload, and then you'd kind of blast them as they would head back. You know, some of them were coming back over you at 20, 30 yards. So it was awesome. So you could, you know, knock down a couple cans and a bluey and put them in your pickup bags and go home. So does that happen anymore?
No, man. I mean, it might happen. It might happen in Saskatchewan or something, rural Saskatchewan, or it doesn't happen anywhere I hunt.
Yeah.
I mean,
those are a lot of fun days.
People have cameras out everywhere now, you know, like you can't, you can't go onto private land or something like that. They track you down. Did you eat those ducks? You shot a lot of ducks with your dad. So was it the old school, like your dad would bring them home and mom would clean them and cook them up or what?
No. We cleaned our own birds. So if I went, we'd all, sit down in our yard and pick and clean and wash off the birds and then cook them the next chance we got. And sometimes if we had a lot of birds, we'd freeze a few or whatever, but we generally ate what we shot.
Now, tell me about your journey into duck calls, which obviously includes your dad journeying into duck calls.
So Iverson Duck Calls, there's a gentleman by the name of Evie Iverson. It's kind of a cool story if you give me just a moment.
Yeah, let's hear it.
So he was actually born Reynolds, North Carolina, but actually was raised in Badger, Minnesota. I think that's up near the border, if I'm not mistaken. It's way up north, but in your territory.
Yep.
Went to the Naval Academy. And then he was in 19. So he grew up duck hunting, big passionate about it, and messed around with duck calls when he was a kid and stuff. And then ended up at the Naval Academy and served a couple tours in the war. And then ends up in a brownstone in Greenwich Village in 1945, recuperating from minor surgery. And I guess the hospital had like a wood shop in the basement. And so he started turning duck calls. And from
when
there,
you say turning duck calls, okay, we're going to get back to that, right? Because that seems like kind of a technical term.
Yes. So on a lathe, apparently this hospital had like, it was like a recuperation place, and they had like a wood shop and exercise equipment. So it was weird. Like normally you're just, working medicine balls, but back then they had lathes, I guess, in addition to the medicine ball. So he started turning duck calls on a lathe by hand. And, he enjoyed it so much. And he had spent 29 years in the military, was probably trying to anticipate what retirement would look like. Mm-hmm. And so then built a little shop in the basement of his brownstone and started making duck calls by hand in the basement of his brownstone. And his daughter used to like to say that he'd be tuning them down there, quack, quack. And people on the street would go, "Where are the ducks down there?" So kind of thing as they walked by.
Funny. Yeah.
Totally funny. So anyway, long story short, ends up taking a couple of those calls down to Abercrombie and Fitch, in New York, and they're taken to them and they start, carrying his duck calls in the store. And the reason I tell you all of that, is because almost 30 years later, 1975 Christmas or 76 for my dad's birthday, somewhere in there, I'm in an Abercrombie and Fitch in San Francisco, California with my mom, and we're going to pick out a duck call for my dad for Christmas. And my mom's there helping me. We buy him a $30 Iverson Rosewood handmade duck call. Mm. Give it to him for Christmas. And by May of that year, he bought the company.
Wow.
So like in between there, because my dad, he's a very creative, talented artist, craftsman. He started going, "Hey, maybe I can make a duck call," and started dissecting it and playing around and trying to make his own call. And then he picked up the phone and called Mr. Iverson, and they became fast friends. And it turns out at that time he was kind of ready to get out of it and retire. And that's how my dad stepped in. And that's when I was 12, 13 years old. And so I grew up in a wood shop turning and making duck calls.
When did, when at Abercrombie and Fitch, when did the teenage boy model with the six pack abs and the jeans hanging down below his underwear start playing duck calls?
Man, I don't know.
But Abercrombie and Fitch, I know. So I don't know what you're talking about. A place
exactly
where you can buy duck calls.
Used to be a kick ass store, not anymore. But I guess maybe the 90s. I don't know because 80s, 90s.
I need a little more here. What was your dad doing at the time that he was in the market to buy a duck call company from a guy across the country?
So he was living a little bit of the madman life. He was a trained artist. He went to art school in Southern California after he got out of the military. He married my mom. And then he got a job with an agency, Soyster and Orenshaw, in San Francisco when they settled back up here. And he was basically doing, you know, they would do creative ads. And so he was laying out Campbell soup cans, literally by hand. Because back then he didn't have, you know, all the computer elements that we have today in software. So, and so I think he was always a little bit of, you know, do I want to, you know, do the commute to the city, make soup can labels the rest of my life? And so he saw this as an opportunity and a way out, and he did it.
And your mom was like, oh, great, you're quitting your job.
Well, there was a little bit of a transition. So he basically did both for a long period of time, for maybe a year and a half, 2 years, and then kind of got to the point where I think we were old enough to carry a little bit of load in the business. And, you know, he was able to sort of build up enough of a book of business that kind of allowed it to buy him off of the other job that he had. So, but then from, I guess, you know, probably late 70s until he retired, and he still does them some, he's been just cranking away at duck calls.
He still does them.
Well, I mean, in the last year, it's gotten a little hard, you know, with the pandemic. And then, you know, my mom's got reasonably advanced Alzheimer's, so he takes care of her. So he doesn't get down to the shop as much anymore, which is something that he and I are kind of talking about what that means. But, yeah, I mean, I get emails on a regular basis because I've sort of taken over, you know, built a website for him and kind of maintained the communication side of the business. And there's 100 people who want duck calls right now, and I'm trying to figure out how to deal with that. But the, just emails who talk in such glowing terms about my dad and what the calls mean to them. And the fact that they got it from their father or grandfather and they want to hand them down or get another one for their son or daughter, like email after email after email, because it's not just another acrylic mass turn call. You know, you can have 10 of those in your bag, but the ones that, at least the story that we hear, is just the meaning that, you know, whatever it is about a call that is handmade and has a lot of intention put towards it, means a lot to people. And so it's kind of cool. It's part of my dad's legacy that I'm really super proud of and want to make sure that it continues in some way.
Yeah, I want to hear more about this, because it seems to me that duck calls, well, like anything, you can get duck calls made in China. I mean, and it's funny that the calls you can get now for basically almost any species you hunt, you can find a call for it on Amazon or on any, you know, you go into a big, you know, Dick's Sporting Goods or whatever. And there's just so many to choose from. I can't imagine this time of year how many duck calls there are at Cabela's, but dozens and dozens, and then goose calls and different duck calls for different species of ducks and stuff like that. But duck calls, relative to all those other calls, have a pretty long and storied tradition. Like there must be guys who collect old duck calls.
For sure. For sure. And I mean, and Iverson's are part of that, those collections. You know, he came, Evie kind of came into the era after that sort of first wave of duck calls that sort of had some sort of patent attached to them at the first part of the 19th century.
Okay.
And then, which is crazy to think about, but he was sort of that second wave. And so he's collectible, but maybe not as much as some of those original guys, but he definitely was influenced by some of those early call makers. And I think one of the things that I'm super proud of is, I think Edie Iverson, I mean, he made a variety of different mallard calls, but for the most part, when my dad assumed the business from him, he basically had one kind of mallard call, and it had one kind of reed in it, and he made it in several different woods. And then he toyed around selling other kinds of calls through the years, you know, a whistle and goose calls and things like that. But I think my dad sort of took and improved upon some of the designs and modernized, you know, the Iverson call. So it was a little bit more, and so he brought a bunch of innovation to it. And honestly, I think improved upon the call. And some guys will say, oh, that old style call, it's the only kind I want. And, you know, people love them, but they're not easy to blow. You know, they're not easy to control. You know, they're super raspy and awesome, but.
Tell me more about that. I guess I'm, you know, my understanding of duck call duck calls is so rudimentary. I know there's a difference between a single read call and a double read call. And I know just from experience that some calls are easier to blow through than others. You've actually gifted me two Iverson duck calls, one of which has rejoined the earth in a slough. Hence the second, which came with a note basically saying, don't you dare lose this one.
Yeah, no. And then you texted me a thanks to an old phone number. Some lady in Texas got a thanks for the duck call. And I'm like, hey, dude, you get the duck call.
Sell me on why a handmade Iverson call is better than a plastic, you know, camo call that I pick up at Cabela's for $19.95.
Well, I'm gonna say this, and maybe this is part of the reason for your podcast, that unquantifiable essence of something that is made by hand and with great intention and thought versus something that is you just throw a reed into in a cork. Because I will say to you, I can talk a mallard out of its feathers with a rich in tone plastic, you know, acrylic call. And I can talk a mallard out of its feathers with a nicely tuned Iverson duck call. There's a lot of good sounding calls out there. So it's not really about the sound per se, but I will say this, there is a tonal quality about the reed hitting wood that is unique and less shrill than a reed hitting acrylic, and you can hear it. But guys became enamored in the late 80s and early 90s about calls ringing and being really loud. And it was really influenced by a lot of people getting into competitive calling. And so I think a lot of mallard calls like Iversons that were really meant to sound more like ducks resting on a pond, you know, you know, kind of guttural and, you know, that those kinds of sounds. Now, you know, guys want to go 25 note hail calls and all that kind of nonsense. Right. And yeah. So, yes,
if they can turn those ducks, if those ducks are 3 miles away and, you know, 1,000 feet in the air, and you can turn those ducks, you got a story to tell.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
the fact of the matter is that almost never happens. I mean, I've never done it.
I will say this, there's some logic to, you know, and I think those are some of the things that my dad tried to change about the Iverson, some of the modifications to the new style call, and certainly the champion call that he made that actually ended up winning the World Duck Calling Contest in 1987. It's actually, to my knowledge, the last wood duck call to win the World Duck Calling Championship in Stuttgart, really? Arkansas. Yes. But David Jane was the guy blowing it. I was back there competing in it, along with a couple other guys as well using Iversons. We had, I think, four or five guys using Iversons in 1987 that year. But again, if you wouldn't do it, but I suppose if you could find that recording of David Jane calling on an Iverson, like, he's so ducky and so good. And I mimicked him because he was like 10 years my senior. And I was like, I wanted to sound like him. And it was so ducky. You wouldn't hear that sound at a contest anymore. It's like, it's all that shrill sort of acrylic sound. So I think that kind of influenced it a lot. I guess I'm really not selling you other than to say that.
No, you sold me for sure.
Yeah, I think there's something about that reed hitting a hardwood like teak or rosewood or African blackwood that has a different resonance when it comes, you know, out of that barrel than it does when you're hitting something that's non, you know, original to the earth, I guess.
Now, I'm hopeful that you are holding one of those Iverson duck calls.
Yes, I actually have two close to me, and it's funny, like, the, you know, what's it, the cobbler's shoes statement, like trying to find an actually functioning duck call around my dad's house. He's got a lot of awesome, like, but I did find one. It's a prototype that he actually have a call. It's an antique prototype that he made like for the Orvis company many years ago. I do. Yeah. So
let's, take us through some duck calls, and Brandon is, you know, might have to adjust some dials and knobs to make this sound just
right.
Yeah,
I'll try to aim it away from the thing a little bit, but okay. I can always go through these again if it doesn't get recorded well. But basically, the first thing that I like to teach people how to make a duck call is a single quack, because as soon as you can make a single quack and maybe some busy duck sounds like the chuckle, you can literally call ducks. You don't have to make a lot of noise on a call. So single quack. And essentially that's a hen mallard sitting contently on the water, quacking, making noise, communicating. A lot of times if you're at a park or out in the wild and seeing birds, live birds sitting on the water, there's a lot of other busy duck sounds. Feed chuckles would sound something like this. And that's just a kind of a
why can't I do sound. That? Why haven't I not been able to master the feeding chuckle? I was taught it was a ticka tucka ticka tucka, but I can't even do it that fast, as fast as you can.
Yeah, some people, I don't know if it's the mechanics of some of the tongue movement that, you know, I don't know.
I cannot do it. There should be something on 23andMe, like maybe it's a recessive trait that you can't say ticka tucka ticka tucka. Like, how fast can you say ticka tucka?
Now, there's a guy that I used to compete with who now has his own call company, Wayne Betts, and he used to do a feed chatter. He sounded like a machine gun. And he wasn't doing like that. He was a little going like his. It sounded like impressive, and I could never do that. But I wouldn't say that I have the best feed chatter, but I've got it. I don't know. Maybe you need Tommy John surgery. I don't know.
On my tongue. I'll get on that. Oh my gosh. Okay. So you got your single quack. Is it only the female? It's only the hen who's making these calls that is it ever Drake?
Yeah. So the Drake mallard does have a quack, but it's very different than a hen mallard. It's almost like it's really guttural in a different way. And you'll hear them a lot of times if you see a single mallard and you give that guy a little quack or a little hail call, and he'll come over. A lot of times I'll hear him, and you do the single quack at him when he's getting close, he'll quack back at you, but it's very different. So what we're mimicking most of the time when we're calling ducks is the hen mallard. She's doing all the talking for the most part.
Yeah. You want to shoot the Drake, you want to shoot the male. I mean, that's right. More of the trophy than and they're bigger and stuff like that. I mean, I know guys who will not even shoot hens. They'll only shoot the greenheads.
Right.
And so the male ducks, the drakes, they come into that female call?
Yes, for sure. And the other thing that you'll hear, and again, if you're out in the wild, listen to some birds out in the wild, you'll hear the mallard kind of go do sort of a, you know, and I guess duckologists or, you know, duck callologists sort of have divided this call into a hail call and a comeback call. But if they're sitting on a pond, you'll notice that birds, they'll do the quacks, they'll do the feed chuckle, and then they'll do like a 5 to 7 note sort of. But that's sort of like, hey, I'm down here. So the hail call, if you will, which has become the 25 note screaming top of the ringing thing. But really, if you listen to them, they're doing 7 notes most of the time. And then like if the birds are flying around, they do get more excited. So if the birds call from the air, you know, and so from a duck hunting perspective, what you're doing is initially doing hail call. Hey, we're over here. And as they come closer, you're moving into quieter quacks and chuckles. And then as they go around, because a lot of times birds won't come into shooting range the first time around, you've got to spin them around 2 or 3 times. As they kind of spin out away from you, you want to get more excited, essentially. So the comeback call is just basically a hail call, just a little bit more excited. So hail call or comeback call may sound. Maybe a little more excited, a little bit more demanding. That kind of thing. So, then as they hopefully react to that and come back to you, you settle back into some of the other calls. So, I mean, basically the 4 calls are the single quack, the feed chuckle, the hail call, the comeback call. And, you know, in competitive calling, you've got to do an adequate version of all of those and put it together in a musical tone to win the thing. And in a calling situation, you're basically reacting to how the birds react to you. You know, you may sit there in the blind and you know, just do low quacks and chuckles to get their attention because they're moving in pretty close. And other days when they're pretty far off, you're needing to make a little bit more noise with a hail call and be more pleading to make sure that they swing around another time to get a shot with a comeback call.
But how far did you go in the competitive calling world?
So I was able to compete in the World Duck Calling Championships twice, once in 1987, the year David Jayne won. And then I went back a couple years later, I want to say 90, 91, 89, somewhere in there. So I competed two different times. I don't believe I got out of the first. I think I might have got out of the first round once. And it's interesting because you have to qualify to blow in the World Duck Hunting Contest. So you have to either win a state or regional contest. So in my case, I won regional contest to be qualified to blow in Stuttgart. And by the time you get to Stuttgart, it's like the Olympics, you know, the best duck callers, and differentiating the sounds is pretty challenging, but no,
I can't imagine judging that at that point.
And some of it's personal preference. And I think one of the reasons, to be honest with you, that David Jayne won that year was and potentially caused controversy by winning. I don't know this for sure, but we always like to talk about it since no other wood call has won since.
Okay.
But I think his duckiness was so compelling, I think that it stood out. And so he got high marks. He kept getting high marks. And so it's kind of cool.
That's very cool. You've made a lot of duck calls in your life. I would guess that making a duck call is a somewhat contemplative affair, making a handmade duck call.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, some of it's, you know, when you're on the drill press, putting holes in blocks of wood, it can be, you know, mundane like anything else. But I don't think I ever, the turning of the wood process is probably the funnest part, because you're taking a block of wood that you're not sure what it's going to totally look like until you round it out and you sand it and put your shellac on it. And you still don't know what it's going to look like until you stop the lathe. And you can kind of get an idea, but when you stop the lathe, all of a sudden all the grain pops out, maybe some colors that you didn't anticipate. And you pull it off there and you're like, oh, that's awesome. And you set it aside and you do that again. So that process of like taking a piece of wood that sometimes you can tell, or you're not sure, oh, this one's going to be pretty cool because of the grain or, you know, the feel of it. And then sometimes just being pleasantly surprised about how beautiful it is when it comes off the lathe. That process is awesome. I think of late, because, you know, I don't have the shop with me. I mean, I've off and on made duck calls virtually my whole life, you know. But one of the things that I've sort of taken upon myself since my dad slowed down a little bit is restoring and tuning up old calls. That's the other thing that goes into it. I mean, you don't send your Richintone in that I'm aware of to be tuned. You know, like you just get another read and throw it in there.
Yeah.
With the wood, you know, there's some things that can happen. So that might just need some modification. So it's kind of fun receiving a call back, talking to the guy, hearing the story attached to it, and then getting it back up to speed for that individual, whether that involves lathe work or just putting a new reed in, cleaning it up and oiling it, which honestly is not rocket science. It's not that hard to do, but it's just enjoyable to restore, take something that's kind of doesn't sound great and needs a little help, and restoring it and getting it to the point where, you know, it's going to be have another 30 years of life if that person chooses to blow on it that long. So
somebody will send you and your dad their duck call and say, you know, a 20-year-old duck call made by Iverson, and say, hey, it just doesn't sound right, or the reed is stuck, or can you, and then you pull it out of the box, you look at it, you blow it, you decide what it needs.
Exactly. I mean, and most of the time, like, it depends. Like, some guys do, you know, do this pretty regularly. Every couple of years they may send it in. Some people just buy reeds and do it themselves. Some guys don't do it for 20 or 30 years. And so by the time you get it, there's just junk in there. The reed's bent, or he left it in a hot car and the reed kind of lost its curve. The cork is loose, you know, there's just the reed platform is dirty. And so it's just a matter of like, okay, clean this up, put a good oil on it, get another cork, get another reed, pop it in there, and it's pretty much back to where it needs. So sometimes it might need a light, you know, file on the reed platform to get some of that crap off. But just think about it. I mean, you're taking that in and out of call bags, dirty blinds, you're eating a sandwich, then blowing your dog call. You know what I mean? The crap that goes through there, you know, and so it's just, there's just stuff that builds up. And, but that's, I think that's super satisfying because usually people, are just super happy to get it back sounding the way that they want it or need it to sound.
Yeah.
So
do you think this is more of a bigger meta question, but do you think there's room in the economy of the future for a handmade duck call company? I mean, can somebody make a living doing that and, you know, meeting people's orders and stuff like that? Or have we just, is your dad just the last of a breed of craftsmen?
It's a good question. I do know that the glimpses of hope that I have, and for me, I don't know that I need it to be my living. So the pressure's not on me to make that my living. My pressure's on me to keep it going and keep my dad's legacy alive. Not only as he's alive, but, you know, later on, and then figuring out what to do with it, because I don't know the answer to that question. What gives me a little hope, as I was starting to say, is just the meticulous YouTube channels that are out there, knife making, you know, boat building. I mean, you know, going into the cabin, going into the woods and building a cabin with a hatchet and nothing else, you know, like there's a certain appeal, I think, to some of that. I mean, and there's woodworkers as well, furniture and duck call guys that are doing things. So I think that there is an intrigue. I don't know if that means you have to commodify your YouTube channel more than just selling duck calls, but
yeah.
I don't know. What do you think about that? Because I do think that there is regularly, like the independent indie music genre, there's always people who don't want to be a part of something that Taylor Swift, something huge and successful. They want to be a part of something that is maybe a little bit more niched and nuanced. And, you know, whether that's a leather bag or a, you know, I don't know. Part of me feels like there's always a crowd that's going to care about something, but maybe it's just not going to be enough. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I do agree with you. I do think that there is a bit of a renaissance in that, in people wanting stuff that's well constructed, and they know who made it, and it's going to last a long time, and it's going to be taken care of. I'm happy to see companies like Old Navy and Forever 21, and honestly Abercrombie and Fitch struggling because those have become these, you know, disposable clothing stores. I do think. I know that for myself and for people I know, a lot of us are spending more money to buy stuff like Iverson duck calls and say, I don't need, you know, you see the guys with the lanyards, right? With 20 duck calls on Instagram.
Yeah.
20 duck calls and 45 bands on there and showing off about how many duck calls they have, which is kind of ridiculous. As though you would need that many, you know, that many duck calls. And I do think there's going to be always a space, I would hope, for you know, people who want one or two really well-made, handcrafted pieces like that. I'm hopeful, but it does worry me some, you know, that there's like, what's going to happen to those duck calls after your dad's time has passed, you know?
Yeah. And I definitely think I grew up in a very interesting place. Of course, my dad in our little neighborhood, we had, my dad who made duck calls in a garage on his own property. And then we had a guy named Bill Neal who was 10 years older than my dad, who carved decoys and kind of carved them after another guy, Fresh Air Dick, who was here at the turn of the century. And he hunted over nothing but the wood decoys that he carved. Now, and so there is a sense in which, you know, these guys that I had access to, I don't live in that world. You know, I do hunt with calls that I participated in making in some way or made completely. Mm-hmm. I don't make my own decoys to hunt over. I use plastic decoys. But I do think there's definitely a passing, and maybe, you know, maybe it's not Iverson duck calls per se, but I think people will be making calls by hand at some level. But maybe the rainforests and some of that wood will be gone, and so you can't do it. And maybe we shouldn't do it in the volume that we did at one time either. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, yes, true. But I'm guessing your duck calls were not the reason for deforestation in South America.
I just threw that in there to.
And it is, you know, that I like to remind people that timber is a renewable resource, unlike a lot of the other things that we do. Well, I want to ask you about one more thing that is kind of maybe ties together our initial conversation about you planting that church. And when you and I first met, we met in church circles. And then of course we found out kind of later probably that we had this shared love of hunting. I, unlike you, did not grow up hunting. So I wasn't really much of a hunter at all when you and I first met in 99, or, you know, when I was 30 years old and just starting a family, whatever. I didn't hunt hardly at all. I maybe had just gone on my first duck hunt right around then, but have become more passionate about it as time has gone on.
Yeah.
But you and I also at similar times went through some struggles.
Yeah.
You know, different in nature. Mine were maybe more personal, yours more professional or whatever, and have, thank God, we've both come out of those and are
alive.
And our friendship is stronger because of it.
Yeah.
But I wonder, when you look back to those hard times, what did hunting or being outdoors mean to you? How did you get through those hard times in those years?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think, you know, those hard times kind of began when I came and picked you up to take you out to Lake Fork to hunt ducks that day. I mean, mm-hmm. that was sort of the beginning of it for me, because I think I had just left the Young Leader Network. And so that sort of ushered in sort of a difficult phase for me professionally, which, you know, you can't really separate your personal life from that either. It was hard.
Yeah.
Because, you know, failure's, you know, not something you welcome.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, you don't, hey, I'm going to fail at something today, but you do. So yes, I would say super important. The whole aspect of being on the water, slowing down, getting up early, watching the sunrise, you know, putting your decoys out, waiting for birds to come. Hopefully they do. Shooting a few birds, working your dog, you know, going in, grabbing breakfast. That whole process kind of runs counter to your life most of the time, because, you know, you might be competitive about it in some regard because you want to get some birds, but really it's about a discipline and a routine and a pace that it seems outside of what the pursuits of life professionally sometimes hold, because you're striving for something, and really you can strive for birds, but you still have to rely upon weather and birds being present and certain conditions that are outside of your control. So there's something beautiful and peaceful about that. I will also say shortly after not being able to transition professionally for a while, decided to help my dad out and took over a good portion of his duck call operation for a period of time after that as well. And that was super awesome too, because, you know, you and I lived in the theological, the meta world, the conversation, the pastoral, that side of life that doesn't have a lot of closure a lot of times. And it's, you know, big ideas and hurt people and, drilling a hole in a block of wood and turning it into a pretty piece of wood that's going to become a duck call. That process of working with your hands, there's something holy and satisfying about that, in contrast to how I've spent a lot of my life. You know what I mean? Yeah. Especially in the kind of work that we did. So, yeah, I think there's there's something about that process that definitely has spiritual renewal qualities to it. You know, how many sunrises do you see outside of outdoor activities?
Well, I'm an early riser.
So wrong guy to ask. But, you know, I mean, you know.
But, man, when you, Jason, when you talk about that pace, the process of it, it's so different from everything else I do. And I love it so much. I mean, it's why it's the thing that I dream about and, you know, fantasize about during the off season. I remember hearing guys talk about that. Oh, when I'm not hunting, all I do is think about hunting. And I thought, well, that's weird. I mean, I like hunting, fine, but it's not that important. But now to me, it is that important. And I understand that. In fact, I can see why, well, I and others, you know, want to like fashion a life around the outdoors and try to do it for a living in some way, you know, figure out how we can fashion a whole life out of being outdoors.
I love watching what you've done in the last several years. And in the last 10, I'm really honored to be friends with you in that regard, but also just as an example standpoint, I know a lot of Cheryl and I talk a lot about, especially in the last year, what the hell do we want to do in the next 10 years? Mm-hmm. And, I think part of what we talk about is getting closer to a life that's to the things that really give us life, you know, being closer to water, you know, potentially living on a lake, you know, having her access to, you know, animals and dogs and things like that. And me a little bit more access to fishing and hunting that I like. And it's just funny. And what I appreciate about where you've directed your life, with some intention is just being able to make that integrate into that part of your pursuit and your profession, which I haven't totally figured out yet, but I'm hoping to.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm doing it until the bank account runs dry, and then I gotta figure out how to actually make a living. But seriously, I don't know. For me, when I crossed the threshold of 50, and you were there for my 50th birthday gathering.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Which I don't remember much of because of that bottle of whiskey that Cavante brought.
God, 900 proof or whatever it was.
My gosh. Yeah. Pickled my liver right there on my 50th birthday. Man, that was just such a reset for me, the 50th birthday.
That's awesome.
Of like the stuff I had striven after so hard for so long meant a lot less to me than being with the people I love, doing the stuff I love, which I guess a lot of people say that. It's kind of cliche even to say it, but for me, it really, you know, that was for me a point, a pivot point in my life. And
I mean, worst case scenario for you, and what I appreciate is like you had a season of life where you leaned into it personally, and even your kids got to benefit vicariously from some of that because you were pursuing those things, and you could take your kids on those trips, on your canoe trips, on your hunting trips, and so like the very fact that they could get wrapped up into that is essentially, you know, why I got wrapped up into it, because my dad was wrapped up in it.
You know?
He pulled me along into some of that, so that's really cool.
Well, I appreciate the journey that you and I have shared. It's so funny because, I mean, I'm sure there are other people who are listening who have similar experiences, but like you and I became closer the more our professional lives diverged. You know what I'm saying?
100%.
Like, yeah. Yeah. When we went our separate ways professionally, like you were no longer running the network I was a part of. And then at some point I was no longer even a part of that network. You were no longer really involved in church life in the leadership sense of starting churches or pastoring.
Yeah.
I wasn't either. And then, our friendship really blossomed over others. Well, just a shared love. And then of course a shared passion for the outdoors. So, I think that's pretty cool. And I do appreciate your friendship a great deal. So
yeah. And vice versa for sure.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And let's, Duck Odyssey is still in my sights, man.
Yes. I know I let
maybe
you down
not in yours.
No, I want to do mine. That. I want to do that. Let's figure something out. We need to hunt this year at least minimally together once.
Okay. I mean, look, I'm not the stumbling block in that.
I'm gonna go to my grave hearing about this. I know.
All right, buddy. Thanks yeah. a million.
Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate
Talk
it.
To you soon.
See ya.
All right, Brandon. So you heard me in the conversation with Jason admit I cannot do the feeding chuckle.
Yes, I did.
But here's my Iverson duck call. I can do a couple blows. Here we go. I haven't done it. You know, I haven't blown the duck call in 8 months. So get little.
It's going to have an excuse ready for you.
I wish you could see my dog Crosby because he is freaking out right now. All right, so there we go. That's my Iverson duck call. Not nearly as good as Jason Mitchell's, but there it is.
Well, hey, if it makes you feel any better to an untrained ear such as my own, it sounded off. It sounded exactly like a duck.
If you were a duck, you would come right into that and I would blow you away.
Yeah.
All right, Brandon. Hey, man, have a great couple weeks and we'll be back with another great guest in 2 weeks. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the Reverend Hunter Podcast.